and player to do it.
But
in rugby, you cannot necessarily do it simply because the phases of the sport don't allow it. There's going to be moments where your top guy is not actually playing or not actually touching the ball. Therefore, you know, it's impossible
for
one
player. You need to trust the other players to be able to do their best, and you can rely on them. That's why I believe, and you know, this is the forever arguments, but I believe the culture in rugby is healthier than the culture in football, because it's less about individual performance and it's more about team performance.
What is very interesting, and folks, I'd love for you to get your opinion on this, if you're a sports person or not, but why is the culture in rugby so different from that in soccer or football? Because it's still a game predominantly played, you know, by a similar demographic. I mean, yes, you could argue that there's a class difference and all this type of stuff, but in reality, I was from a working class place. I play rugby, so I think it's there, but the behavior is very different, which is relevant for today because we're talking about culture, folks. We are talking about workplace culture. We've got an amazing show lined up. This has been a really interesting conversation online for this week. We talked about it on LinkedIn. Everyone's like piling into the comments and all this type of stuff. So it's going to be super exciting. So welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 105, bringing it to you every Friday. It's going to be a great show, folks. And actually, I should mention, we have a few changes today. By the way, folks, you should be aware that there's been like a series of complete screw-ups by Hung Lee over the last 24 hours. I don't know whether you're aware, but there's been like mistake after mistake. So I think there's going to be yet another mistake happening during the course of the next hour or so. So anticipate this. But we're excited today because we're going to be talking about this, but we're also going to be – oh, shit. Mistake number one. Firstly, sound check. Straight away, I'm missing it. Can anybody hear me? Please say hello if you can hear me on Crowdcast, please. It will be very interesting to know. I think we can, actually. That's fine. Okay, on LinkedIn, can you hear me okay, folks? I need to get some sort of indication that we are live and we are on there. So can you give me a thumbs up, thumbs down, something like that? Just let me know you can hear me okay. Same goes for Facebook. With Facebook living it, folks. So now we are Crowdcast, LinkedIn Live, and Facebook Live. Three places, should be 1,000 people watching this. Okay, awesome. Thank you, firstly. So we're very excited. It's going to be talking about culture. We have upgraded Adam Gordon, and we're bringing back, because Nico, you've been on the show before, I believe. We're bringing back Nico Blia Silvestri. Nico, how are you doing? Great to have you on the show.
I am good. Like I was telling you, I'm exhausted because I'm tired and life is exhausting, but I'm good. I'm super excited. It's obviously a subject that I love. And you've found some amazing people. So I'm super, super hyped about what they're going to say and their point of view about company culture.
This is very true because I don't know whether people have been aware of the conversation I'm having on LinkedIn, but I said, look, can you actually quantify culture? Because I personally am a bit tired of everyone talking about culture in a very rhetorical way. Culture this, culture that, we're all saying the same thing. How do we know that's true? Is basically
exactly
what I'm trying to say.
Exactly.
Everyone is talking about, yeah, we're flat hierarchy, we're inclusive, we do this. Yes, it's all the same, but how do you know it's true? And I reckon you have to measure it because how else do you know it is true? How do you separate the rhetoric from reality? We had lots of people not happy with that position, which I'm happy to entertain, you know, the reasons why that is, but let's press forward with this. It's going to be really cool to figure this one out. Okay, so Nico, let's start with the newsletter. Firstly, give us a few things that you read last week and you thought was interesting, and we'll cover those off real quick.
So overall, again, great content. Thank you for sharing. I think the two articles that really struck a chord for me. The first one was the one from Jim. Where are the female CEOs? They obviously focused on corporate America, but I think let's face it, it's a problem we have. All over globally, every location, and specifically the piece around the pipeline entering the job market, the percentage of employee per level, race and gender representation in the corporate pipeline in 2016, I thought was both great data and very scary. And it just made me reflect and think a lot about quotas, no quotas, sourcing, no sourcing, where does it switch? Where is the system fucked? And sorry, people, I curse a lot. I'm French, so I will do a lot of cursing. That's usually what I do. This article was, I mean, first of all, Jim is usually very, very good in his content. He's very talented. Every stuff that he produces, I'm like, wow, mind-opening. But I thought this article was very, very powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I think Jim is actually, he's always been an amazing content creator, actually. One of the pioneers of creating great recruiting content. If you don't know Jim Stroud, shame on you. Go follow Jim Stroud. However, he's actually upgraded his game. I really think he has, because even at the very high level, he's even gone further. Because the content he's producing now is so well researched and so well referenced. This is not just a dude talking about his thoughts. He's actually outlining his argument, and he's often outlining different positions of the argument so you could explore the case. And I think that's a real credit to him, a real credit to Proactive, who's the company he's working for right now. You should totally check out his blog. I've shared it in the chat stream there on LinkedIn. Follow Jim Stroud. Check out that blog. It's awesome. What else, man?
That was the first one that really clicked for me. The second one was the BBC piece around data experts becoming football best signing. And I thought for two reasons. I thought, number one, probably goes very well with the discussion we're trying to have today around is something ever relevant if you don't have data? How do you go from I feel we have a good culture to I can actually show you we have a good culture, which is basically what football experts, do scouts are trying to do. It's like, you know, it's like, I'm not telling you this guy is great. I'm showing you by data that this guy is great. So I thought that was great. And I thought as well, what happened this week, and I'm going to go into sports again. I'm sorry, people, normally I don't go that much into sports, but I don't know if anyone is following football, what the putsch of the Super League that happened over the week by the supposedly 12 biggest club trying to do their own Super League and everything. I think that's a great, great, great parallel with looking at company culture in the sense of like you have some top leaders of those clubs that decide, now we're going to go this and this is our culture now and we're going to go for this. And you have the reality, the employees or the fans in that specific thing that are like, fuck this, we're not doing this and we're going to push against this. And there's a massive misalignment in terms of data, again, on what is culture, what is not culture. And I thought this article was great for the leeway of today's discussion.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for people who are not aware, I've been monitoring, I mean, I'm a sports fan anyway, but I've been really interested in how sports clubs actually assess and recruit talent, because obviously they are very clear on the requirement to do that. But they are also now very much driven by numbers, and even to a degree that may be uncomfortable for us in the corporate space. For instance, we know that, football teams will measure the height of a young boy, for instance, at a certain age. I mean, imagine doing that. His kid's 7 years old. You're going to measure the length of his foot or something to figure out what his growth potential is. You think, hang on, what is it? You know, this seems very uncomfortable. But this is what sports teams are doing to try and predict whether this individual is going to be having the athletic ability to be that type of player. So very, very interesting. And this post by The B basically said, look, the sports, that argument's been won in the sports world. Like we're not even close to having the conversation in the corporate world. Ethically, we're struggling with even getting there. But in the sports world, it's like, yes, you need to measure it. We're going to hire data people to measure this stuff. So super interesting where we're at.
Yeah, it was a great piece. It was a great piece.
And you know what, Nico? I think the ethics of it is part of the issue that we have in measuring culture. I think, you know, I'm in the position you can. A lot of people are saying you can't, but I think there's a bigger component of people saying you shouldn't.
I mean, you know where I stand. I believe you can. I believe you should. I believe if you don't track it, if you cannot show it, then it doesn't exist.
You've left the world of active recruitment to build a product in order to do this. So you better believe it, mate.
Sometimes I miss the world of recruitment. It was easier. It was nicer. That's what we built. And as well, that's why I chose this article, because a big inspiration for building Platypus was the video game Football Manager, which is everything is about data driven and it's about collecting data to be able to take the right decisions. And it should be the same with organizations. Everything that you decide around your people, whether being talent management, talent retention, or talent attraction, should be around your culture, right? But if you don't have data, then what is it? And how do you base this decision upon?
Yeah,
that's exactly my point of view anyway. Yeah.
No, I think the point of view is relevant because we go back to gut feel, and you know, all good feels aren't equal. That's the problem with gut feel.
No. And gut feels can lead to discrimination. I mean, let's face
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Before we kick off and bring on our guests, tell us a little bit about Platypus.io, because this is where you really roll the dice, Nico. For people who don't know, Nico was like this high-flying head of TA, you know, TA head at Revolut, I think, Peacon, and, you know, cool companies of that type. So this guy was like one of us at one point. Then he actually stopped it and thought, no, I need to build a product. And you're building something culture-related, aren't you? So tell us quickly about Platypus, man.
Very, very quickly. Platypus, basically what we believe is that every single person that work in an organization has an impact on the culture of the organization. And the only way to understand the culture of an organization is to understand what drives people, their cultural drivers. So what we've built is basically a platform that collects, gather all this data anonymously from all those people, and then put it all together with an algorithm that we've built to give access to organization the cultural map of the company, an helicopter view of what drives the culture of my organization by what is important to my people. It's our view that basically the very simple logic is if you have enough people in an organization that value work-life balance, that either becomes the culture of your company or you lose your people, but you need the data. That's what we've built with Platypus. That was the whole idea. And we don't believe culture are corporate values. We believe corporate values are extremely important, very autocratic, defined by top management, very, very important. But the example I always use, and people have probably heard me say this before, I'm French, liberté, égalité, fraternité are beautiful, beautiful, amazing corporate values, really not the culture of France, and really not what you're going to experience if you travel to France. And voilà, I made my point. You're gonna have.
Can I just say one thing? Whenever Nico prefaces what he's about to say with "I am French," I get terrified because I'm thinking, do I need to mute this guy? Like, is now the time when I need to get him off screen? It's like it's not your get out card to say what you like, Nico. You know?
No. It's so I don't want this to turn into like a. Happy to have a chat with anyone that wants to discover more, is interested to look at how we build this.
Well, let's get on with it, because I think the reason why I wanted you to sit in the co-host seat today is probably because you're of the view of you can actually collect and analyze this because you've built a product around it. But let's get other people in that might have a different view, and then we'll test it in the conversation, right? So let's see whether we can get some folks in to help us with this chat. So I'm going to bring on a whole load of people if they're there. Let's bring on Leila. This is Leila Motet. I think we can also bring on Brian if he's there. If he's there, yes, he is. Cool. You know, we might go for three people here. Hang on, let's just stick with these two first. Hang on. Yeah, Nims is there as well. Cool, let's bring her on. So we're going to go three people first, then we bring on Natasha and Elena, I think. Oh, there's Leila.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Ça va?
Pour l'instant, ça va.
D'accord.
Hi. Et toi?
Ah, ça va bien, merci. Good. The French collective. We are good.
Indeed. So, Leila, you've been on here before, but people might not know you. So, can you quickly introduce yourself to the crowd? Who are you? What it is you do?
Of course. So I'm a talent intelligence manager within Philips, and what I predominantly do is organizational culture assessments for M&A and internally in the organization as well. Really close topic to my heart, and education lays in psychology.
Yeah, amazing. Great to have you back on the show, Leila. And we have Nims Dawan here. Nims, how are you? Great to meet you, actually. We haven't had the chance to properly meet. But Nims and I had this great conversation on LinkedIn. I thought, you know what? We need to get this lady on to have a chat with us. So Nims, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are and what it is you do?
Yep. So I'm Nims. I am an organizational design and development consultant, and I work in the civil service. So my main focus is building much more effectiveness and health in the overall organization. And Brilliant. Culture is a very big part of that.
Yeah, I've just shared Nims's LinkedIn there, as well as Leila's on the chat stream. Please connect with these folks. And we have Brian as well. Brian, great to see you. Can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, and what it is you do?
Hi, Hung. Thanks for having me. I'm Brian Evia. I'm originally from San Francisco. I live now in England. I've been working with startups and high growth companies since the dot-com era. I've been the head of HR for a couple of venture-backed companies in San Francisco and then a couple in London. I've been a management consultant, and I do a lot of work with an organization called Astia, which is a global community of more than 5,000 people that helps high growth women entrepreneurs and gender inclusive teams with access to capital, business expertise, and leadership development. And I'm very proud to be a part of that community. And it's great to be here. So thanks for having me.
That's a very polished pitch, Brian. You've done that before, haven't you, sir? Yeah, the man's in demand. Okay, let's talk about this topic at hand. So, and this is leading off to the title, Quantifying Company Culture. Let's just deal with that at the very high level before we dive deep into it. It was a bit of a provocative title, but you know what? Here, I need to sell the registrations for the show, don't I? Quantifying culture. The reason why I care about this is because, firstly, we intuitively reject the idea. Instinctively at gut level, we think, no, of course you can't do that. And secondly, we have a lot of feeling to say, secondly, should you? So let's go with those two questions. Let's go with you first, Leila, on this one.
Yes. So a short answer to the question, you definitely can quantify it. That's what psychology does. It's quantifying basically psychological aspects of human or of a collective, which culture is. And yes, you definitely should, because as Nico said as well, if you don't, you just don't know where you're standing and you can't mitigate culture issues, for instance, if you just don't know and have no clue how your culture looks like. So two short answers to this.
Two short answers. I love it. Let's keep the answer short in this place and then we'll go into a deeper conversation, right? So Nims, let's go with you. What are your thoughts on those two questions specifically? Can you quantify culture and should you?
I'll go with the first one. Yes, you should quantify culture or attempt to identify the themes, because then you know what you're working with, be it healthiness in your organization or kind of some sort of dysfunction in your organization. So which ones do you want to suppress? Which ones do you want to amplify, etc.? In terms of the quantification, I think that's a little bit difficult, because I'm of the belief that yes, you can quantify some of it, but there's a huge part that you can't quantify. If you consider your organization as a living system or as a person, there is a part of you that I can't quantify, your unconscious that I can't get at. And all of those are actually driving a large part of our system. And so, yes, we can deal with the obvious elements, but sometimes we can't account for what we can't see.
So really important point there, folks. What you're saying, Nims, is that yes, you can and should. However, you need to be aware it's by no means full picture.
Absolutely.
And in fact, there's going to be hidden components to the culture that are currently beyond our ability to collect and may actually be forever beyond our ability to collect if the act of collecting influences the culture, right? The participant observation problem. Okay, really good. Okay, Brian, let's go with you. Thoughts on these high-level questions?
I absolutely think that you should make an effort to quantify it to the degree that it makes sense for your particular organization. I also agree that it's not wholly quantifiable. I don't think there is an equation. I don't think this is a binary thing. However, I'm a traditionalist when I think about culture, and it's really, for me, it's the sum total of the problems that the group is trying to solve, the problems the company is trying to solve. And usually the people in power say, this is our culture, and they need some way of hearing from the people what the culture actually is. And usually it's something different. So measuring that gap and that alignment is the thing that's really important, especially operationally. So you absolutely have to try.
That's actually something I want to, you've given us a thread I want to try and pick up and lead with now, Brian. The idea of the aspiration, so the leadership aspiration, they probably think about what they want their business to be. They think about, we are this type of company. You know, is there a CEO these days that hasn't written that document down somewhere? You know, I think in CEO school, that's the first thing they teach you. you have to have the culture document. Okay, so what is but there's a gap between that rhetoric and what's actually happening on the ground. You want to kind of make the distance and close that gap as much as you can. So how do you take this first step towards doing that? What are your thoughts on this? Nico, by the way, feel free to contribute, even though you have a job today. I fully consider you an equal member of the screen. So, feel free to get your thoughts in as well. Anybody on this idea of closing the gap? Like, how do we do that?
You know what, like, super quickly, but you know my take on this. Like, I really have issues when I see, like, a company, our culture, integrity, respect, and all those fluffy words that that companies love to put on the walls of the organization and everything. That's not culture. And seriously, if you have to put integrity on your wall, there's probably something wrong in your organization in the first place, because that should be a baseline. That's not culture. That's like, that's how you should be as a person, a human being. So that's my issue with corporate values, like, because they are autocratic. They are defined by top management, by leaders and everything, saying like, this is who we are. That's our framework. I don't see them as culture at all. It is the framework of what leadership wants the organization to be or stand for, or work or function. That's great. But the reality, like Gary said, is that there's more often than not a massive, massive misalignment between top and the ground troop, the people and what they live and what they experience in terms of what is my culture of the organization. That's the pain.
Okay, so actually two things here. Firstly, should it go top down then? I mean, should the leader has defined this. Is the project to push it, the culture down to do it this way? Or is it to emerge upwards? Is there a direction of travel, I guess, to the articulation of culture?
Nims is shaking her head.
So I agree with Nika. I think values and corporate values are a projection of what they want the culture to be, but what it isn't. And actually part of that is, I think, some of the shadow pieces. So if they've got integrity on there, I think that's, you know, a signal to say actually they're not really doing that particularly well. In terms of measuring the gap, I think what I have done in my work as an OD consultant is identify what the leadership at the top level believe the culture is like, and then what the rest of the organization is like, and then explore how big the gap is. And what I've noticed is time and time again, the gap is significant. To show actually there is such a disproportionate perspective of what the culture is and should be and what the real lived experience is like.
Cool. How do we measure that gap, Nims? What is the technique to do as a survey, I guess, or something?
I talked about storytelling in the chat that we did on LinkedIn, and that's how I get to identify kind of what the hidden parts of the culture, what's the culture really like. And it's as simple as asking your people, this is a place where, and letting them fill in the blanks. And then when you've got enough of those statements, right, you identify what are some of the key themes that are popping up, you know, what's the overall picture. And I think there is a belief that culture is this homogenous thing, but it's not, because our perception is our own reality, and what we experience is going to be unique, and people can have wonderful experiences and equally terrible ones. Doesn't mean to say that they're both wrong. They can both exist in the system, and that's what leaders have a real trouble dealing with, is that difference.
You know, I can see we're in trouble with this conversation already, because it's not going to be done in 1 hour, is it? It's like a huge topic to talk about. Okay, listen, before we begin, continue. There's a bunch of questions happening in the chat stream already. That's amazing. But can you put them in the ask a questions function at the bottom? Just copy and paste your question in there, because we're going to get to those questions at the end of the show. Continue to use the chat stream to chat, but we're going to go to the ask a question section at the end to make sure we cover all the questions off. So Nims, you said some really interesting things there. Let's play with this, folks. Particularly this, I love the idea that what is on the company wall might actually be the opposite of what, that's actually a description of your gaps. Because if you felt you needed to articulate it, you have a concern with this. Hence, this is why you've made it an important thing. Whereas what may truly be culture perhaps is subconscious. It's like, you, of course you would default do it this way. It wouldn't be that obvious for you to articulate in public. So folks, have a think about that. The corporate values that you have may be actually the opposite of how you're operating businesses. That's a shocking revelation for me, but I think very interesting to play with. Oh my God, my brain is fried already. it really is. In terms of the process of doing it, I was really interested in this open-ended question style that you use, Nims. So this is the idea of simply allowing people to complete a statement, and then free text way of getting it, and then just doing a lot of reading, isn't it?
Pretty much, because I think what we do in surveys, and actually any type of theory, involves the subjectivity of the person who created it, right? And that includes algorithms. Sorry, Nico.
No, it's true.
You know, so it's, you know, everything is loaded with subjectivity. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to give, you know, the participants the space to fill it in with their lived, what's actually happening for you. And, you know, it could be traumatic. It could be wonderful. It could be everything in between. But it's that open level of inquiry where we get to that, you know, the subconscious or the unconscious of the organization, because that's basically how they really feel or what they really think about the organization.
Yeah, so what I do is, and I think for me personally, it worked really well when I was consulting leadership levels, or rather like really confronting them with the actual state of the art, is to combine quantitative and qualitative assessments. So A, on a first hand, really have this traditional survey assessment where, of course, there's subjective bias in, but at least you can really present, okay, this is a cultural metrics, this is where you are in a cultural metrics, and then really underline it or even add the value by the qualitative assessment that you do to go to the granular levels that a survey can't measure. And I think that's something for me personally, which works really, really well.
The only issue with those ones, and they work, they're probably, it's probably the best way of doing it, is that, like you said, you do it for leadership, because it's almost impossible to do it at scale for massive organization. Yeah, you can do it for a startup, 23, 50 people. You could push it to maybe 100. It's going to take time, but you can do it. But when you go to like 500, 600, I mean, monster organizations, then what? That's the issue, right?
Well, not really, because if you take a sample size of your organization, you know, you're going to get a kind of, it will kind of level out in terms of, you'll start seeing the themes over and over again. So you only need to take a representative sample with your storytelling aspect to get a view of what the culture is like at the various different levels and across the various different, I don't know, operating areas. You won't need to scale it, you know, on a whole. So when we put this out, a lot of people recognized and saw that actually, yes, this is fundamentally what we're experiencing. So that's the way that we've gone about it.
Are you also then looking into the differences between the different groups in the sample? Because that's something which I see within Philips. We are 80K and there are massive discrepancies between geographies, markets, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's also something really to look at, because there are certain, let's say, especially talent pools, which have, let's say, the culture benchmark. That's something that people would love to talk about as well in the context of agile and stuff, right? And really granularly understand how different culture is within one organization, I think, mm-hmm. is also really interesting.
Yeah.
So cultures, and then the question you ask yourself as well. So you've done this, you do your process, you get the results. You give the Polaroid picture of this is what we are right now, but like you just said with the algorithm, the reality of what you just gave is already not true anymore because it's changed. Time has passed. People care for other things. So how do you make it just ongoing?
Let's hold on that first, because the dynamism of culture is something we definitely need to talk about, because we can't just keep snapshots. No, it's super important, right? Like, a big part of the problem with corporate values is that you've taken a snapshot that may have been true 2 months ago, but you know what? Things change real quick. So, you know, do those things still stand? What we've identified here, though, is that there may be a problem with collecting the data. So there's a data collection issue, because if you've got a certain size of business, obviously it's extremely difficult to collect everybody's information at the same time, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, remember, it's a moving target. Now, NIMS is saying it's possible to do sampling, take a sample. But then Layla has also mentioned, you know what, how well you sample is very, very important, because you're going to have a multifunctional, multi-unit, multi-team environment, oftentimes very different in terms of how they behave. So how can you possibly, you've got to be very careful, if you like, in terms of that sampling side that you're doing. Okay, lots of things to do then. I mean, I guess we need better tooling is one thing, I suppose. You know, part of me is thinking, can we not measure it with, like surveillance technology? I hate to say it.
The brilliant idea. I mean, like, yeah, genius. I think, and maybe we just, you know, just track and put people in a little chip, and then we know everything.
That would be optimal. But
I know.
Let's imagine you can't do that for ethical reasons, right?
Yeah.
But all of this will get us towards uncomfortable ethical stuff, I think, because this self-reflective type of behavior, I think, is uncomfortable, right? But let's say you can measure heart rate or something like this, and you can measure deviations from the norm in the heart rate whenever the CEO sends an email or something. That would actually be quite interesting cultural fact, wouldn't it? To say everyone's terrified of the CEO. That should be very interesting information for the CEO, him or herself, to actually be aware of. That, you know what, you're triggering these biological impacts when you're sending this email in this way. You probably need to take off the caps lock a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So what about widespread distribution of tech? Can we use technology to solve the data collection problem? Thoughts on this, Brian?
Well, I'm going to look to Layla and Nims, who are dealing with much larger organizations than I deal with. My view is that as Layla started out by saying, as Nims started out by saying, you know, there culture just operates on different levels. There's a visible level, and then there's the invisible level, the individual level. But ultimately, for me, culture is an expression of power. Because it's you know, these are about what's acceptable and unacceptable behavior. So surveillance isn't really the way to do it.
That's branding. Really I could say personal analytics, people analytics. You know, something. You could rebrand that. But yeah, go on.
Yeah. So I don't think surveillance is the answer. I mean, I think what you're trying to do is create and maintain environments where people feel that there's consistency, again, with what's said, the organization wants to be, and what the organization actually is. And, you know, if it says this and it looks like this, if everyone gets really clenched when they hear their boss or their CEO, you know, that's not necessarily because the CEO is frightening. It's because there's a power imbalance. So surveillance isn't going to get to that, and analytics isn't going to get to that. But I understand your point about having better surveys and better data, and I think Layla and Nims are very well suited to talk about how to segment that and look for trends and directional working.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, and I'm just going to be really blunt and open. I do see, especially in big organizations, really the struggle in collecting this global data on culture, because there is a workers' council in each country, and then in Italy I'm allowed to collect the data, but in Germany not, and then I have like half a business group. There are definitely a lot of data restrictions which make my life harder. So coming back to the sampling, I think that's, for me at least, the only solution so far to really scale the culture insights up and derive insights. But I'm also still in a question mark. Do we develop that in-house? I know that Amazon does that, for instance, which is really interesting. They really develop their own culture analytics and tools. So yeah, there's a lot of potential in the future for that.
What about your thoughts on things like organizational network analytics? And this is kind of surveillance tech in my view, even though it's anonymized surveillance tech, right? So it's like tracking digital communications through your business and then just trying to figure out whether that gives you any insight. So stuff like, frequency of email sends the overall volume of messages sent on Monday seems to be higher than it is on Thursday. Why is that? Because we're doing this. This person sends an email and it triggers off these like a signal of activity on digital communication, whereas this person sends a message and actually no interaction. So that can tell you something about the relationship this person has with the group. Go ahead, Nico.
I think on this one, it might not tell you exactly about culture. It might tell you in terms of influencers, like who influenced who in the organization, but you don't know what type of influence they have. However, I think it's super important to get this data to be able to then build this bias algorithm around who influenced one and so forth. It's good data. I don't think it's surveillance because it's, thank you, GDPR, anonymous, and you cannot look at what was in the email, who sent it to what and everything. But I think it's extremely interesting data in terms to like understanding like a bit like you said, Brian, like it's more about like who has power within the organization and what power is it? Like, so where is the influence and where is the influence going?
I do think that you could derive really interesting collaboration strength of your culture, for instance. So I do think there are certain culture implications which you could derive out of that. But again, it leaves a big room to interpretation, I think, which is a problem there.
Yeah, in terms of O&A, I mean, organization design specialists use O&A quite a lot to design their organization for optimum effectiveness. So, you know, if you find that communications are going from one area one person to another, that means that there's a close working relationship, and that's important to maintain. So if you get rid of that person and move them to a different time zone, that's going to create huge impact, right? So for me, culture and structure of the organization is somewhat intertwined. They are not separate entities. They are connected, and we need to make sure that we remember those connections, because if we don't, then we're going to kind of lose huge parts of our culture if you don't pay attention to them. If you look at an org chart, it gives you a lovely picture of a box, but doesn't tell you how the organization really works, right?
Yes,
it doesn't tell you who influences who, who's the most important player in this organization, and you know where the information sits, where the knowledge sits, doesn't tell you any of that.
But at the same time, me answering an email doesn't make me align with the culture of the person that's sending the email. I have to reply. So it's just around the network, right? It's
No, but you can say something. So for instance, let's say even the length of the email, you could do a character count on how truncated your responses are. Like, let's say you get a lot of like short email responses. Probably no one likes you, Nico. You know,
no one likes me. I know that. I don't need a tool. I just walk around. People call shit at me when I pass in the office. It's fine. But I...
Okay, Brian, you're about to say something.
I was just saying, operationally, I think there's limited value in the number of characters in an email. I think there are, of course, all sorts of interesting things in big organizations around how decisions are made and time doing this and that and meetings and blah, blah, blah. But I think that the broader context here for leadership is to understand what the situation is that triggers. You know, Nico says if someone says something and everyone jumps up and goes crazy, is that a result of some outside force that everyone is responding to or trying to take advantage of? One of the great tools in investigating an organization's culture is understanding what actually people believe and what they do during really high times and really low times when there's great stress. Do people respond the way the company wants them to, or do they respond some other way, or do they respond the way that actually is the general operating method? I mean, this is it's all power for me. It's all power. And until people feel that they have enough representation and there's enough balance, and by the way, this gets into diversity, inclusion, and belonging, until they feel this, they're going to go along with what the person who joined the organization before them taught them, and then before them, and before them, and before them. So you can pick up all these signals, but it's never going to be a clear binary thing like your sports team, except the context of what's happening, the context of these of the organization's ups and downs will reveal so much about the organization's character.
Well, this is actually a really important context that you've introduced, because we've encountered this type of situation last 12, 18 months, right? Where we've all experienced the crushing sense of external stress. And that is a big test at an individual level, you'd say it's a test of character. So maybe we can extrapolate and say at a group level, it's a test of your culture to see how well you've responded. Are you resilient? And we know that right now CEOs are all thinking, oh, how do we build a resilient culture? Well, this is like, how do you do that? I mean, there's going to be a bunch of people, a bunch of businesses that have been found wanting in the course of these last 12 months. They may then realize, you know what, we've not had a powerful enough culture that's caused us to stick together under conditions of adversity. How do you go and repair a culture that you think is weak?
There's one thing that's super interesting on this is that, okay, yeah, we want resilient, but at the same time, there's a massive call. So we want for people to be vulnerable and accepting that they have weaknesses and everything. So which one do we want? Which one is good or bad? And is it both of them? But that's...
Well, vulnerability is not the opposite of resilience. I think.
It's not the opposite, but like by saying that I've suffered and I failed and you know what, we crashed as an organization or the culture, you're showing that you're vulnerable and that we did and it's okay and it's accepted. Some CEOs, like you said, yeah, we want resilience. We go through this and we grind and it's great and all.
All right. Now, I accept that as well. Sometimes to front it out and to be tough is also like a very visible signal of resilience, even though there's maybe a gap between what's actually happening compared to, you know, what you're actually projecting, let's say. But that's kind of going to lead us to a three-hour conversation. So let's take it back to...
It's not going to lead us to a three-hour conversation because it's the organization's ability to hold both of those and use them when it's contextually appropriate. It's an either or.
You have to dumb it down for me, Nims. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So, you know, an organization culture doesn't have to be make a choice between being, you know, a vulnerable space or a resilient one. It can be both, right? It can choose when it needs to be strong and, you know, in a crisis and deal with things, and when it needs to be vulnerable and accepting of its own issues and its failures.
Yeah,
I don't understand why we need to separate them.
I think I think that a vulnerability or psychological safety / trust is actually the antecedent of resilience. If you don't have a culture where you trust, where you can be vulnerable and where you're psychologically safe, you will not be resilient, never ever. So I think the vulnerability is actually the antecedent of resilience.
So building a company that's resilient is building a company that's inclusive, basically.
Exactly.
And accepting of people's, like, you know what, I'm not like you, and I felt this differently, but it's okay, I have the space to express how I felt this and how I want to move forward with this. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
There we go.
End of the show. Let's have a good evening. No.
Done. We solved culture. That's awesome.
There's more to discuss. What we want to go back to, and by the way, folks, I know I'm bleeding a lot of your time here, and I'm going to ask you some quick questions and then get Natasha and Eleanor on. But let's talk about corrective action. So you're doing some analysis, qualitative, quantitative, and you've identified, there's like some cultural issues in our business. How do you like articulate that? How do you present that information? And what do you do about it? Any experience, you three, in doing any of this type of like triaging of a culture? Anybody?
Yeah, so what I do is I sit a lot of different leaders together in one room. I just had that on Monday. It was quite interesting. I think it's really important to have different organizational departments represented in this workshop. So you have business transformation, you have HR, you have business leader all together. And you present exactly this gap between leadership perception of culture and the actual state of the art of the culture. And then really just guiding them through a behavior change workshop for themselves to understand, okay, Jesus, there is such a huge gap between what I think my organization is and what it actually is, and then really guide them through a problem-solving approach. So how do we, for instance, become less hierarchical? And there we go into this whole, I think what Nims also mentioned, aspect of org design, org structure, and culture, which ties so crazy together. So those are the kind of approaches that I take. So really simplistic workshop.
Yeah, so the first thing is actually getting people together. I mean, it's like sending a report or a PDF, that's not going to land anywhere. You've got to get them in a room, right? Which actually leads to, how do you do that in a remote setting? So maybe it's harder to correct the culture in a distributed way than it was before. Who knows? But that's something I guess we all have to explore. Okay, let's go to you, Nims. Triaging a culture. Have you ever done this? And yeah, how can you explain us a little bit about what you did?
Yep, I've done a triage of a culture. Very similar to Layla's approach. It is about getting people in a room and saying, you know, this is what it is, the good, bad, and the ugly, and there's nothing to hide. And we show, like, this is what you're really good at, right? And for example, COVID response, you've been great at this, right? And being really supportive, but you've been shit at this, and we need to work on it. But there is an inherent belief about culture that is difficult to solve because it's nebulous. But what people forget is that it's real small actions that really count and really matter. It doesn't need to be big. It doesn't need to be difficult. It can be as easy or as difficult as you want it to be. And it could be in a culture where, for example, collaboration is an issue. Go chat to someone that you've never spoken to and start building those relationships. Really simple thing to do. But I don't understand why leaders, CEOs think that you have to have the whole program of activity to solve this problem.
It's yeah,
so, small things.
So, yeah, so what you're saying is you can do some small correctives, basically. You don't have to roll out a program of change, which is hugely intimidating, always going to fail. But you could say, we can see that collaboration is weak, so we're going to institute a certain time of the week. We're going to have like two people in different departments. You're going to meet each other for 30 minutes, something like that. Yeah. Boom, done. Okay, cool. How about you, Brian? Give us something that you know people can use as a corrective.
Well, I think Nims makes a really good point about CEOs wanting to put together big things, and that's often the response, especially the bigger the organization. The counter to that for a CEO who wants to do the right thing the counter to that, I'm afraid, is that many, many people in authority don't really want to make the changes necessary to have fair cultures and consistent cultures. They're fine doing just enough. They're fine getting along. And I'm not being pejorative about it. I'm just saying this is a natural human response. It's very, very natural to say, I'm not going to wade into all this stuff. I'm going to just do something different. So I think it's very intimate work. I agree that you need to have the groups. I agree that you need to appeal to people in small steps can really make a difference. I think, however, I think if you think this, you identify a cultural issue, you find the most powerful person within that group and you go to them and you see if you have enough of a relationship with them and there's enough of a trusting rapport where you can talk to them about some of these things and why it really matters to them personally and intimately that they make some changes. Because usually at that individual level, and all change is individual, you can have some movement and then you can go and they can be your advocates and you can do small steps or big steps or what have you.
Well, that
Brian,
is actually...
you make a really...
Go ahead.
Sorry,
well, go ahead,
Brian, you make a really interesting point about culture, because sometimes I see culture being used to maintain status quo, that real resistance not to change because whatever it is working for the people in power.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's working well enough. And they don't, again, people in power don't see, because the downhill effect really, really becomes mitigated. And a lot of bankers went remote at the beginning of the first lockdown and they said, hey, this is fine. I'm a New York banker. I'm working in the Hamptons. Everything's great. And they didn't recognize that the people lower down the organizations had really, really difficult times with this because of childcare and healthcare and you know, poor internet and just all the other things that powerful people don't think about. So again, it's that gap. It's a power gap. Mm-hmm.
So this is really interesting. I was about to say something that what if explicit culture, as in articulated culture, what if that's simply ideological support for the maintenance of hierarchy? But that will obviously lead us to communism. We don't want to talk about that. Listen.
No, but it's Enron. Enron famously had their values on the walls about how integrity and trust and blah blah blah, and they were gleeful about cheating people out of money and screwing energy consumers all across the United States. So it's absolutely can be just complete, completely artificial.
Well, this goes back to Nims's point. It might actually be a disguise. Maybe a smokescreen as to what's really going on. So listen, this has been really fascinating. There's a bunch of questions here that's been asked. I might actually have to bring you guys back to help me answer these questions, because certainly I have no ability to answer them. So I'll try to stay with us for the rest of the show, folks. I'm going to say goodbye to you now off screen, because I'm going to bring on Elena and Natasha. But wonderful having your contribution. Nims, Brian, and Layla, amazing, amazing conversation so far.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation can keep going. It really can. I mean, it's like
you know the meme of the guy that goes like this.
My brain is devastated. What's left of my brain is like I've got to scrape it together off the walls of my
I don't know if you had to bring communism into this discussion though. But
no, there was no need for that. I agree. It was a joke, but I think what will happen is that joke will not land, and it will probably be screened off YouTube or whatever, reported for whatever.
Maybe it's a cultural issue between the five people that were in the room.
Maybe we don't know. But anyway, let's truck on, because we've got more people to bring on to the show. Let's bring on Elena. We'll bring on Natasha as well. Natasha's been amazing in the chat stream. I'm kind of like reluctant to bring her on screen because of all of the amazing content she's sharing in that chat stream. Like all of these blog posts here, which has just seemed to be super interesting to review. So what have we learned on that? There's a gap between rhetoric and reality. We know that. Ideal case to capture quality and quantity at the same time, although there's a data collection problem, because how do we do it without surveillance tech, which, maybe we should get less squeamish.
No, that's not a
point. It's totally possible. I think it's okay. We're not ready for it. I get it. Let's think. Oh, here we go. There's Elena. Elena, how are you? Good to see you.
Hey, happy afternoon to Europe.
Happy afternoon.
Good morning to the US.
Good morning to North America. We've brought on North America to help us out with this conversation. So, Eleanor, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Yeah, most related to this conversation, I am the co-founder, CEO of a company called Skill Scout Films. So we bring culture to life through film, through storytelling, which is what Nim said. Even more related to this conversation, I was professionally raised as a design researcher. So when we think about the invisible stories, I was really the one to go out with what was a huge quant data set and really start to bring to life, who is that 32-year-old mother of two who shops at Target? Well, her name is Sarah, and she is from St. Paul, Minnesota. So that's a lot of kind of where my background comes from, which is more of the capturing the invisible and much more from a qualitative set.
I love it. And this qualitative information, I think, is apparent. It's very, very important, critical for us to even have a conversation about this topic. Okay, Natasha, for the people who good to see you, and for the people who don't know you, can you quickly intro yourself, what it is you do?
Absolutely. I'm here to balance the amazing Elena on her qualitative side with some more of the quantitative bent, although I have so much appreciation for all those sources of research. I'm a people scientist, founder of a small consulting firm that I run by myself, doing a lot of this work and a lot of the quant side of, you know, culture transformations, as well as behavior change and other things in the organization. And I'm finishing on my PhD in workplace psychology in the next few months. So as soon as I log off here, back to the thesis revisions.
Amazing. Well, thank you for taking your time out in having a chat with us, you two. With regards to the conversation we've had so far, I mean, there's been so many threads that we could, they're spiraling off in those different places. Let's talk about measuring stuff if we can. During the conversation we had on LinkedIn, I asked the question, one thing that really came back as more consistently than anything else in terms of the people who said you can measure it was attrition, like as a crude measure of culture. Like you can say as an attrition number to say, look, 25% of the people here leave every year. And then on this year, 85% of the people left. And then on that year, 65% of the people left. Probably you can tell something about the culture of the business, unless it was a seasonal hiring type of business, I guess. Are there other types of metric that are relevant to the question? A CEO sitting there and thinking, there's a problem in my culture here. I don't know what it is. What measures could you put into place to assist that person to figure it out?
I will go, and I want to let Anna spend some time as well. Yeah, over here in the box to the right. And so there are a bunch of different, you know, categories of measures, some of which were already referred to earlier by Nims and Layla and others. There's the outcomes like turnover, right? That would be one of the final, you know, pieces of information from a given employee, right? If we start to peel the layers, the onion layers of Shrek and things like that backwards, we'd see things like commitment of different types to the organization. How do you know if someone wants to stay or needs to stay or feels like they should stay, even if they're not leaving? That gives us a little bit more insight. There's, you know, different kinds of metrics of employee engagement. And a lot of those would be considered the climate. So we're tapping into that snapshot of how people are feeling in the moment. So if I'm like, oh, you know, there's water on my head, like this is what I'm experiencing. And then I look up and I'm like, oh, it's because of the culture. It's raining right now. That is really the cause of what's happening. And sometimes we're like asking each person, like, okay, this person's head is kind of soaked, right? This is like the symptom of what we're seeing in the climate. And then the culture metrics can actually get into things we've been talking about in the chat and that Brian was mentioning too. What's the worst behavior that you'll tolerate? How do you decide when there are competing issues? Do you fire a high performer who's been harassing people, or do you just let them because they feed your bottom line? How does it come down to it when you have that pressure to do things? And basically, like, that's the difference sometimes between metrics of culture and values and competing values versus climate stuff we often are measuring.
This literally is beyond my intellectual ability to bring this together.
Yes, I'm trying to be.
I don't know whether you're aware, folks.
That was the simple version.
I'm paddling hard. trying to stay afloat here.
Eleanor, keep us grounded.
No, but I get it. I totally get it. So what you're saying is essentially there's all kinds of things you know about, like the snapshot issue. Like, in other words, how do you track the dynamism of culture, right? Because it's going to evolve over time, even in moments. Mm-hmm. And even is culture just a collection of moments? You know, maybe it is. You can never get real
Correct.
Time, if you like.
It's a living system. It's absolutely a living system. You know, one of my favorite parables, which I think really brings this to light, are the seven blind men and the elephant. The truth is that our company isn't one truth. Our company is multiple truths. And we're all touching the elephant all at once, and we think it's this, and we say it's this, and we want to argue, when in reality, actually, the elephant is a whole when you step back. Really is this living organism of multiple narratives. And that inevitably becomes what we think of culture. And I think, you know, one of the biggest shifts we're seeing generationally, I think a lot of this has to do with technology, a lot of this has to do with platforms, is it was a lot easier for leaders to say, this is the narrative.
Oh, yeah.
Because they can control that. Now all of us have a platform. And we all now have to have accountability for this is also the story of the elephant. It is very much a yes and here, which becomes both the opportunity and the challenge when we think about how are we retaining talent, how are we attracting talent, that we now have an opportunity to really kind of dive deeply into specific stories that we know are going to be relatable to certain groups and certain subsets. So when Layla, for example, talked about, geographies and culture, like that is huge, right? When we think about even how we think about work and the culture of work, very different in very different countries. And so example, when we're doing projects on an international scale, when it comes to companies, the culture of working in Israel, very different than the culture of working in America. 100%. And so when you have companies that are now trying to kind of try to tell this similar story, what we see is actually like we've had productions halted because they realize that even planning a video event becomes something that they have to stop because they're realizing we can't put lipstick on a pig.
That's where
the culture is so different.
That's where you see the massive difference between the corporate values, that you can have global corporate values. We stand for this. And like you're saying, completely true, subcultures in every location. And I would even argue within the same location, like in Copenhagen, you go to a company, you'll have a different culture in tech, in marketing, and in finance. That's just the way it is. Exactly. So it's super cool what you're saying. But it must be a nightmare for your work. Yes.
Well, it depends how you charge, Eleanor. I mean, it'd be amazing for it. Don't charge on finished product. What you want to do is charge on like the number of times you talk to me, and then you can make coin.
I mean, I think this is why film is but a complement to how you are telling the stories of company. I've never said that what I do is the silver bullet for how we tell stories.
Yeah.
And there's multiple ways, you know, certainly for how we do it.
What about, Eleanor, you've taken us down this route direction, but I want to go with it because it's really interesting about narrative control. And we're in a situation where I think you are right. Like all of us now are very powerful devices to communicate narrative, right? And in fact, some of the biggest people, biggest influencers on the planet are these like 19-year-old kids on TikTok or whatever. And they're literally with a mobile phone, nothing else. But they can move markets. There's no doubt about that. They can literally, and they could sink a company for sure. With the decline of narrative control, there's going to be managers, leaders, etc., going to start thinking, hang on, that's a problem, because we're going to have to present something to the market. That's what we have to do. We have a brand, we have an image, we need to project that. How do we maintain control of that narrative? By the way, this is very real for stuff like brain food. You'll notice, for instance, we've never had a guest from Facebook. We've never had a guest from any of the huge brands that are out there because they can't get it through PR. when I tell them, hey, this is a live stream, can't get it through PR. So narrative control is like really critical for a lot of these big corporate businesses. How do we handle this sort of tension between, yes, there's a diversification of narratives, but then you have this corporate sort of thing, which is saying we need to have a single narrative?
This is going to be real rudimentary and like very anti-basic in comparison to what Natasha can say. You know, but the truth is, inevitably, it's going to be the audience and our generation of candidates that are going to dictate that. Because the truth is, these 15-year-olds or whomever can smell a stock photo and a stock story and a stock video from a mile away, and they are going to call bullshit. So it really doesn't matter, right? Like, inevitably... you know, what's going to dictate this is the fact that we are so savvy when it comes to understanding, even from a video, what we consider trustworthy, what we consider to not be bullshit, that the candidate's going to call out on it. And there have been some major fails from companies and some major wins having been called out on that. So I think, you know, the opportunity of the fact that everyone has a platform, despite the fact that it's also a very challenging thing, is that you are now having voices calling out and not being afraid to call out some of these CEOs.
You force people to be genuine. You force people to be genuine and honest about the reality of my culture, of what I experience, of what it is to work in this organization. It's actually a good thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I was about to say exactly that, Nico. It's almost like everyone talks about transparency now as being the thing, but perhaps it's actually the only practical thing you can do. Because if you're attempting to maintain an image, firstly, that's going to take you a huge amount of investment and time and almost a police state type mentality to control all of this, and it will fail. At some point, it will inevitably fail. A system of control is going to break down. You're much more safer, if you like. If you want to play it safe, it's actually a de-risking strategy to go transparent first. Because then you're just open, you're out there, and you're not trying to necessarily massage or overly engineer a message. Super, super interesting. Let's talk. We actually need to deal with the questions, folks. You two are on sort of screen at the moment, so you're going to be on the spot. There's 10 questions there. I've not read them. I'm going to read them out loud, and we're just going to go for them and see whether we can deal with them, okay? So let's see how they go. Okay, this one from Steve Ward here. Let's say this. We are told that we should hire for culture ad rather than culture fit. Given the discussion about about measurement, how do we measure what needs to be added? Nico, you want to take this one? You're a big culture ad person.
Go ahead, Nico. Such a good question.
I'm going to do a sales pitch about Platypus. That's why we've built the tool. So come and have a look at the website. It's basically you build your culture ad on where you want your culture to go. Recruitment is the biggest impact you can have on the culture of your organization. It's as simple as this, because you bring people in the organization, they're going to bring their values. They're going to bring what they push for in an organization. So you need to be able to know what is my culture ad. The step one is what we discussed an hour ago, is what is my culture? Number one, because obviously you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you are, 100%. So understand where you are, understand with top management, with leadership, where you want to go, and then base your recruitment based on that. That's my quick answer.
That's okay. It wasn't quick, Nico, but that was good. So what you're basically saying there, Steve, is like culture ad is like, what are you adding? You've got to look what's missing. You can't just say it's culture ad as a cliche. You literally have got to analyze what are the gaps in your business. And you may say, you know what, we are like very poor at collaborating. The culture ad there, the component you're looking to add are people that are good at collaborating. So You've got to do the analysis first. It's not just a cliche. Okay, this one from Sarah Sen. So if culture is subconscious and not something you can articulate, how do you measure it? Let's deal with the premise first. Is culture entirely subconscious and can you articulate it? Eleanor, do you want to give this one a shot?
It's all about behaviors. I mean, behaviors are trackable. Culture is not. You know, so I think in the way that we're talking about it, culture is yet a concept. And it's going to be very different, you know, just based on the company that you're at, which inevitably has everything to do with, quite frankly, the tone that leaders have set. So that's my short answer.
Yeah. So just to rephrase that, that real quick. Basically, you can basically communicate behaviors. You can collect all of those behaviors actually into a spreadsheet and say, yeah, this is what we're doing. But the culture of it is something that's always going to be a little bit more nebulous than that. But look,
that's the nuance. That's the invisible glue, right? And I think that's the sexiness of it, right? The sexiness of it is like, ooh, culture, it's so mysterious. But the fact is, because it is, and it always will be. And I think if we can just embrace the magic of culture and recognize that we can't fit this into a box, but yet there's behaviors that maybe we can track to provide some sort of picture, but still inherently lean into the fact that there is going to be magic and mysteriousness in some ways about that. I think if we could all accept that, we wouldn't have to, you know, just make so much of a megilla about this.
I think a lot of people would intuitively agree with your sentiment there, Eleanor. So thank you for that. Even though I think you could probably do it in that microchips or something.
Going with the flow of it, right? It's like the de-risking you're saying, Hung, like don't try to craft a narrative upstream. Don't try to like fight against what is measurable and try to improve that instead of like kind of going for the maybe most difficult invisible thing to measure.
I think there's a romanticism about it, and we miss the romanticism. I think there is a something to be said for we can be overly analytical, and sometimes you can destroy the romance of something by analyzing it to death. You know, imagine if you were in a romantic relationship, for instance, and all you were doing was studying a spreadsheet as to why it was so amazing. Probably it will not be that amazing for very long, right?
It's not what you do.
Unless you're sharing the spreadsheet with her or him, and it happens to be, you know, you're of like mind. But yeah, you can ruin the romance of it, you know. It's in the same way, let's say you're an expert at breaking down why a movie is amazing, and you've got all of these, you can literally you've figured out the formula why a movie is amazing. Probably you'd struggle to enjoy that movie again because you're looking at the formula all the time. Anyway, that's a segue. Let's talk about a question that Dan's asked here. What questions to ask to uncover important aspects of culture to focus on? Open question. Anybody on that? You want to figure out what the culture is, or you want to, what's the question you would ask that person or a bunch of people?
I think Nims like put it really nicely from a qualitative perspective. You know, what it's like to work here, like this is the kind of features of that. Other people in the chat and we've discussed, like, what are the kind of behaviors that you'd tolerate. I've dropped a lot of links because I'm just like brain feeding everybody in the chat there in terms of some research that's been done and some measures that exist that have kind of formulated this into some simple frameworks. Those are always, you know, oversimplifications, but there's a lot to do from like a qual and quant side as well as what Ellen does with those really rich qual kind of stories and through the film that I think you leave that prompt and then you see where it goes. But you'll know more than me.
No,
I have a short answer. I want examples. I want stories. I want examples. Don't give me some bullshit about like, tell me what it means to be like a humble organization. It's like, tell me the moment when you saw humility in this organization. Give me a specific example. Because if you don't have examples, if you don't have stories where you can really talk to that value, where you can really talk to something, it is not a value.
It doesn't exist. Then it's just telling.
Yeah. Like literally, it's just, can your colleague talk to an actual specific tangible example of how that value or whatever insert you are looking for was manifested?
So to deal with that question from Dan, essentially what we're saying is that it's possible to ask for scenario for examples, like similar to competency-based interviews, right? Can you come up with these examples? And also you can test it with scenarios, right? You could say, I'll leave it open in the same way that Nims mentioned earlier, you know, what does it mean to you? And then have that person finish off and free text it out of the way there. And this could be free text
and artifacts are huge. Artifacts are huge. So the big thing in design research is the show and tell. We are not just here to talk. Like I want you to, you know, if we were an office, give me a tour of the office, like help me understand, like show me, you know, what does this really signify? Like, help me understand this. Like the more like artifacts we can show, and there's a lot of show and tell, I think that's going to be, if we were talking just about questions or approach, that's going to be a big one.
You know what? That is a really interesting. For some reason, I'm thinking about museums here. And when you mention artifacts, but actually studying what we treasure and what we house in museums itself tells you a lot about the culture of the business, of the culture that's actually doing the housing. So yes, in your office, like what is prominently displayed? What are the things you care about most? What is, you know, the things that you're communicating to other people? That itself, it's not the superficial communication you care about. It's the reason behind it. And what they're trying to make you feel is the thing that you need to really dig into. Okay, let's keep going with these questions, folks. This is going to be like interrogation, okay? So apologies for the experience. But we have
got 1 minute, unfortunately.
Have you?
So Natasha is going to end up rounding
us out. I can't carry it all by myself.
Okay, so if you've got to jump, Eleanor, can you say one more thing as a piece of advice to people who are thinking about, we need to know more about our culture? What would you advise them to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is we can all take an ethnographic mindset when it comes to our work. And so if I think about the ethnographic research mindset of how, you know, anyone can come to approach when they're thinking about this is, one, you have to get out of the armchair. If you want to understand how a lion hunts, you don't go to the zoo, you go to the jungle. That's number one. So things around like, look, if you're trying to understand what it's like to work as, you know, a production operator, go out to the shop floor, my friend, observe and start to participate. I think the second one is that we have to zip our mouths. We think that we know a lot more than we do. And inevitably, the third is we have to empower our employees as experts of their experience. We certainly are not. We are here, you know, very much to listen. And then the fourth is to embrace the unexpected. We have to go into this to assume we're embracing surprises.
That's amazing, Eleanor. We have to get you back for a longer session. Sorry we had to cut you off. I know you got to go. But I love what you're saying. Particularly, maybe you should give like the employees space to tell their own stories. That's what we've got to do. And that's not necessarily just filling in a survey. It's like giving them the space to tell their and share their experience. Eleanor, listen, great seeing you, by the way. You have a very good day. And I'll speak to you soon, okay?
Okay. Bye, guys.
Ciao.
Cool. She's one of my favorite people. Really is an awesome person to connect with. So please do that. Okay, let's finish with these questions, folks. And Natasha, sorry to lean on you on this, and Nico also. But let's crack through. Which conditions allow humans to flourish as part of a living system? Which metrics matter in the context, in that context, and how iteratively can those metrics be measured? So in other words, what makes a human being flourish in this culture? How do we create the conditions for this to happen?
Is there not a pyramid that talks about this?
Are you talking about Maslow?
There's a pyramid, and then there's a better way, kind of evolved from that. That pyramid is maybe the like dodo bird, and now we've got you know, some better stuff, but it's good because we don't need to start from scratch. And so the modern version of, you know, those basic needs, the psychological needs that we all have, is we all want to belong. We need to belong. We all need challenge, mastery, to feel competent and not stupid, not only at work, but, you know, everywhere. And we need autonomy to make our own decisions. When we take that, we base our, you know, values, our behaviors around that, and we lead and, you know, work in teams in ways that represent and support those values and those needs in people, that's where flourishing happens. That's where motivation happens and everything else. So it's a great place that I like to start, and a framework that I find really helpful. Beyond food and water, we need a lot, you know, for our minds, for our social relationships.
Yeah, I think so. There's actually good science behind this now. We can be confident to say the sense of belonging is a critical component to all of this. So if people don't feel as if they fully are members of that group, that will impact massively on their ability to thrive. They've got to basically feel as if they are a 100% aligned. Member of it.
Yeah, aligned with the culture.
But it's not only a line. I'm reminded here particularly of, I mean, I read a really amazing post. I'll share it with everyone here, which was about how life is like as an outsider. And it was about this Serbian person who was a multiple immigrant. So he immigrated when he was 15, I think, to the United States. Then he left the United States, went to Germany. So he's a multiple immigrant. He's a photographer. He's taking these pictures, he's interviewing. He wrote the most beautiful thing I've read for a very long time. I would recommend everyone read it. But he spoke about this issue of belonging. And sometimes when you're reminded that you do not belong, even a micro moment of reminder can be very, very difficult for you because it destabilizes this trust that you initially had that you did belong to that space. So taking it to the corporate context, are you creating the conditions where people are reminded that they belong? And if in truth is they don't belong, like why is that? And why is that the relationship that you have with this employee if that is not the case? So there's some good science behind that. Okay, keep going to questions. From Steve again, if we are to measure something, it needs benchmarking. How do we propose to do this with culture? It's debatable whether you need a benchmark. It's ideal, but you can measure it anyway. You've got to start somewhere. But any thoughts on the question generally? How do we do it with culture in terms of cultural benchmarking?
Nico?
Yeah, but you're going to disagree. And then since you're the one with a PhD, I'm going to look like a dumbass.
I don't have
but you know what? I'll try anyway. I'll take that challenge. It is my belief that there's no really good or bad culture. There is a place that is not good for you. We just said about belonging, right? Like, I don't feel I belong here. That doesn't mean other people cannot belong here. So in order to do benchmark, a benchmark is what? It's to tell you, like, if you're good or bad, or if you're, like, doing well or not well, if I'm very much simplifying with my French rugby brain. In my mind, they shouldn't be benchmark. In my mind, they should be an indication of what your culture is today, where it's going, perhaps, because you could have data that gives you an indication of how it's going to evolve across time and everything. But I'm not really a massive fan of benchmarking, of like, we want to be the same as Google or Amazon. I don't believe that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And Hung, I'm sure you agree that, you know, you can use it as a crutch, right? You can say, oh, we're at the same level as someone else. We also have the artifacts. We have the beanbag chairs. Therefore, we're fine. I think that it strips those measures of their relationships between other things, which, as you know, researchers, that to me is more important. Like, does that measure of culture predict the kind of, you know, turnover that we care about, the kind of commitment, the kind of financial, you know, outcomes and things like that I've dropped in the chat? That matters more to me than, like, 72, 77, oh my God, we went up 5 points, like, amazing, right? So I think it can just be a crutch on an analysis.
And you know
that's
what?
That's my problem with engagement surveys, actually, as well, to be honest, mm-hmm. because a lot of it is vanity metric. A lot of it is we're tracking it because we have to, and look how people are engaged, but on what? And is it truly what matters to them?
That's, I'll say one thing real quick, but basically there's a psychological impact on creating a table as well. When you create a leaderboard, it actually changes people's behavior because they try to move up the score line. And if you're trying to kind of get the points, that in itself is not the purpose of doing the scoring. I think one way to do benchmarking, I think, is to benchmark against yourself over time. So that is probably a better way of doing it rather than cross company.
You're tracking how you're evolving. Yes, but benchmarking versus others.
Okay, we have to fire through this, folks. Let's go with this. A company's culture is in a constant state of evolution, whilst its values make up the foundation. Doesn't culture only really exist at team level rather than company level? So Paul is saying, you know what? Values are going across the company. Great. We can have this high level. But really, the cultures that matter are a lot more local level. They're like sub-company culture. They're literally at the team level. One team A operates differently from team B. They may actually be in the same department, but the components, individuals in that group will have their own culture. Thoughts on this?
I love this, Paul. It looks like Nico's hesitant, so I'm excited to get into this discussion. So I'm a Teams researcher. I didn't talk about this, but the one idea I love, and I stole this from Silicon Valley, if anyone watches the show, is middle out, right? You got top down, you've got your grassroots, bottom up, individual people, and then you have the team where these needs are met, where you belong or not. You don't belong as like an individual person, right? You belong with the people that you're working with, and you are influenced in your experience of the company by your direct manager, by the people directly around you, way more than someone far away. And so when we think about the team experience, we can do things like culture add to the team. We can do things like, do you feel safe to bring up opposing ideas in the team, right? If we take people too much, again, strip down by themselves, isolate them from everyone else in those surveys, for example, we're not getting to the culture and experience for that person. So maybe Nico, now you.
No, I agree with you. It's more, no. So, like, I think around the question, like, I agree with you. What I'm going to experience in terms of the company culture is my experience of the team, That's what I'm going to experience. Yeah. I'm not going to experience the overall. But however, saying that there's no culture overall, that's not true, because the culture overall is the mass of all the subcultures. So you maybe have more trends. It's you're getting basically you have a microscope and you zoom in on what is the subculture of the team that I'm going to be part of. Yes, but saying that company's culture cannot be looked at big scale, it's not true. It's just less powerful.
Yeah,
you can actually impact it. Yes.
But also you can roll down big cultural decisions that will affect things at team level. So for instance, you could say, look, maximum team size is 8 people, like arbitrary number, whatever it is. Yeah. But if you did that, I would say 8 because that's my number, you know. if you roll that out, then that actually will influence all those teams will experience things.
How many on a rugby team? Because I don't know anything about
it's
rugby.
It's 15. It's 15 aside.
15, okay.
Yeah, it's 15 aside. No, I say 12 because I think like more than 12 people, it's super hard to manage more than 12 people. But maybe it's 8. Maybe it's hard to manage. Maybe it's, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it gets exponentially the dyadic, right? The relationships, it like blows up really fast.
Yeah, there's a mathematical formula to it, isn't there? So, okay, this one from Pedro. Let's ask this. How should an organization address differences in culture within different? So this is actually related. So I think Pedro is saying perhaps divergence in teams in terms of their behavior could be problematic. How do you address that?
I mean, is it problematic? Is it not? They can be, but they don't have to be problematic. Like we said, you know, like we work in a different way in Copenhagen than we do in New York or than we do in Berlin. Does that mean that we work worse or better? No. So they will have, you'll have different behaviors, different drivers in different team. I think if you actually want to look at it, it's more linking it with performance. Which team is performing the best? And then do you see certain cultural values that you see in those teams that you want to replicate in other teams within your organization? That's the way I would look at it.
And on this, and Sasha, we're going to ask you the next question. We can't do them both. Okay? On this, it could be that there's two different ways to have high performance. So it may not be the case that you want to eliminate microcultures. So you might, a monolithic culture might work, but maybe you should experiment with a homogeneous, sort of a heterogeneous culture. Moving on. This one to you, Natasha. Is there merit in creating terms to define culture? I.e., at Google, the term googliness used to measure actions against company values. So, in other words, is it worthwhile branding culture, or at least creating, you know, almost like the Americans do? Actually, you know, they describe things as un-American. And Americans, which is not a joke, you know, intuitively a lot of Americans understood what that was, but it's kind of vague, right? I mean, for external people, it's like, well, what do you mean? So I think what Alexander is saying is, can you or should you do that with a company? Natasha alone.
So what we're talking about with heterogeneity, I would say no, because what we're ending up doing is creating those boundaries that are easy to, you know, just quickly say someone doesn't belong. So my understanding, and I haven't worked in Google directly, is sometimes they have these meetings about hiring folks. They'll say, oh, they don't express Googliness, right? And instantly it's like, shut it down, right? We don't hire that person. So that could be, you know, a symptom of the problems that they've been having, you know, recently around race and different recruiters, people have been fired for speaking up on things. Can that end up being more of a damaging idea? Or the American kind of ideal looks a certain way. And so some people, you know, try to suggest that the country should change, and they're considered un-American, right? I think there's more risk in that, because it's hard to just bring the heterogeneity and all the differences mentally into like one thing, and then that thing is branded a certain way. And then I hate just making new terms for things, because it usually ends up confusing everyone, right?
Like less terms,
culture, and, you know, is it employee engagement? Is it experience? Is it this? It's like, but what is being measured? Like, matters more than what the wrapper label is.
Okay, so there's two things really interesting there. Number one is the invention of new terms, the coinage of new terms may actually be an approach to confuse the situation, because you may not want to have those things measured accurately. So there's maybe a question mark as the motive behind creating these terms. And secondly, we might also want to say it is an exclusionary approach. Like, the purpose of this is to exclude, but do so in a kind of a codified way.
It's okay, because, you know, it's not Googly.
So again, I'm not saying that's good or bad necessarily either, because sometimes by being exclusionary, you can create tighter relationships with those that are included. So this is how you create elites, for instance. And there's no question that, you know, the big tech companies definitely are elites. I can understand why this term was particularly emerged from that particular company. Okay, let's move on. This one to you, Nico. Is the only cultures that matter the cultures that are exhibited in a high stress situation? So in other words, it's all BS until it gets hot, right? You'll see the true culture when the pressure's on.
I don't agree with this. I think you see it, like, generally you see it every day. Yeah, you might see something that's a little bit different under stress, under pressure. I strongly believe that people don't change. People become more of who they are under stress or under high pressure, like we said. So I don't think before stress, it doesn't exist. It's not culture. It is. It might be a softer version of it. And you might see some of the values that climbing way more under stress than others, but you still have a very strong indication of what your culture is when you're not under stress.
Yeah, okay. I like that. I hope that answers the question, Ben. Okay, the last one to you, Natasha. This is from Sarah. It might have been the first question in, but here we go. What are your views on how an external organization could get permission to talk to leaders about culture? So how do you do that? So you've got this external observer issue. How do you actually gain the trust for this intimate exposure of how this business operates? Any techniques to do that? I mean, actually, Natasha, this may describe your job in many respects. So how do you do that?
It definitely does. And in 5 years of consulting, I've learned what Elena probably already knew, you know, walking into this, which is talking less, asking more questions, and, you know, being able to let go of the control that I, as a perfectionist, you know, always am trying to have to let people discover things for themselves, right? Even running, you know, workshop or coming in to speak with people, it's easy to say, this is what we know, and this is what you should do, and this is this, and just follow that path. And it's much better to say, here are some principles like you might not have known about, let's reflect on these, and then how do you want to move forward? Because that ownership that they hold and the skills they will build are ultimately going to serve the company best in the future, right? So I don't have to come back there and say the same thing, repeat myself, you know, and see the same problem a year later.
Yeah, a great answer, Natasha. And I think hopefully with the increased cultural consciousness that we have, like the awareness that we need, that this is something that we can kind of deal with, people will be more open to have those conversations. Yeah. Okay, whoa, my mind's blasted. I don't know whether you guys are. I need to drink about five beers at the moment. So listen, Natasha, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing all of your amazing content on the chat stream as well, By the way, Natasha and I have spoken as well with Eleanor and some other friends. We're going to do like a culture-specific show. So this will not be a brain food project, but it will be something that we're going to talk specifically about company and corporate culture. I was thinking initially to do it on Clubhouse, but maybe we'll wait until it becomes more democratic, because one of the things I had a problem with was that, okay, you're putting in a place where only iPhone people can have it. There's a classic case of elitism. I really have this, a bit of a wry smile when you have inclusion kind of conversations happening in the Clubhouse. You think, that's not very inclusive, bro. But anyway, we're going to try and do that. And it will be culture specific. It'll be talking about these terms. Definitely follow the people in the show if you want to find out more about that. Nico, you're kind of invited if you want.
Would be nice. I would like that. Yes.
In there, it's like very female centric. Right?
No, well, what I'd need to do is to probably track the amount of words that Nico talks about. You know, I'd love to monitor the amount of words that's been spoken. Nico, is that 10%? That's perfect. No. Okay.
Fair. That's
Natasha,
fair.
Listen, I want to let you go. So thank you for contributing to this show. Been amazing having you. I'll see you soon, okay?
Talk soon. Hi.
What a great couple of guests here. I mean, every guest deserved a 2-hour interview alone.
You needed to do like a 6-hour brain food show just to even scratch the surface.
Well, everything. Platypus back on like later this year, so maybe we should do a round.
Because I think
there's would you like to see that, folks? If you're interested, if you've enjoyed this, let me know. Give me a thumbs up, thumbs down. The feedback is going to be important. I mean, sometimes a lot of people want to just hear about operational stuff, like how do you do sourcing properly and all this. important, but at the same time, sometimes a deeper dive like this might also be enriching in all kinds of ways, right? So anyway, listen, that's about it for us. We're well over time. Thank you, everybody, for joining the show. It's been amazing. Join us for next week. We're going to be talking about senior exec leadership hiring. Nobody knows how to do that. I've never hired a CEO. Have you? Okay, we're going to bring in exec search people. We're going to bring in internal leadership recruiters. We're going to be talking about what is different between recruiting at operational level and then hiring the senior people. It's often confidential, incumbent often in place. Guess what? You can't source for this job. You can't advertise for it. How do you even develop the relationship to have the conversation, to start getting candidates? Make sure you follow the channel, folks. It's going to be amazing. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the day. I'll see you later.
Au revoir. Ciao.
Okay, Nico, listen, I want to thank you for being a great host and guest as well, mate.
It.
Yeah, yeah,
it was
really good.
It's always fun. I mean, you know, I like you said, I speak too much, but I mean, I just enjoy those formats. I mean, we learn a lot, we share a lot. The guests you found were amazing. I'm thinking of inviting at least two more for the Platypus, you know, webinars on culture and everything. I mean, it's,
I think so,
awesome.
Man. Yeah, I think everyone here really needed more time. So you speak to the audience here, and everyone was like, "Yeah, keep this person on longer." So I think getting them onto the Platypus series would be amazing, mate.
Like we do the small series, so it would be awesome. Yeah.
Cool. Well, listen, when's your next rugby match, man? Are you back on this weekend or something? Or what?
No. 8th of May. So I've got 2 weeks to prepare myself psychologically for the pain I'm going to get after and realization of like, okay, I'm old, it's over. But yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, there's no physical preparation that's going to be sufficient now, mate.
It's over.
It's all mental. You just got to think, okay, just deal with it.
I had to either go buy a Porsche or go back to rugby. I don't have a license. I'm going back to rugby. That's it.
You have
it's
to
simple.
Play. You have to
play. Yeah.
Okay. So listen, well, next time we see you, it'll be the neck brace. And
I hope it doesn't happen now. Now we said it. It's going to happen.
Now I said it means it doesn't happen. Okay. No. That's it, folks. You have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you soon.
Ciao.